thanks to our sponsor, AvePoint. If you like The Cloud Show, you will love the Shift Happens podcast with Microsoft MVP and Regional Director, Dux Raymond-Sai. Each week, Dux talks with one of the industry's brightest stars about their most challenging modern workplace or digital transformation projects. He uncovers the players, organizational hurdles, and last-minute surprises that inevitably arise when ambitious people try to impact their workplace. Season 1 features FedEx, Wells Fargo, Heathrow Airport, United Airlines, and other industry leaders. Go to www.avpoint.com/blog/shifthappens or search for the hashtag Shift Happens. That's one word, hashtag Shift Happens, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe today.
This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 381, where CJ and I are going to sit down and chat. What did I do?
I'm supposed to be doing it.
Oh, yeah, you are.
This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 381. Today, AC and I are going to catch up on some news. Recorded live October the 15th? No, what are we now? Yes, October the 15th, 2020. This episode is brought to you by ShareGate. Does managing cloud spending keep you awake at night? Trying to figure out how your budget is being spent is enough to give anyone goosebumps. Our friends at ShareGate understand that most cloud architects and developers want to create great applications, not count dollars and cents. That's why they built ShareGate Overcast, to help admin control Azure costs through transparency, collaboration, and simplicity. With anomaly detection, AI-powered cost forecasting, as well as personalized cost recommendations in a unified Azure governance platform, you'll see results from the moment you connect Overcast to your tenant. To start a free trial of ShareGate Overcast so you can get back to building big ideas, visit ShareGate.com/overcast_CS. Back to the show. I forget what day it is, man.
I don't know which one of us is supposed to be doing this today, apparently. So,
so I don't know what day it is. You don't know who's doing the show. We're all over the map.
Hey, at least we both showed up. We both have recordings going, and we're going to do an episode. I don't know how good this one's going to be. The way that we've started this so far.
We'll just roll with it, but please don't expect much. Like, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. What classic. A start.
How are you anyway, other than that?
I'm actually doing good. Man, this has been a crazy week already. There's a conference going on, a virtual conference going on called the European SharePoint Conference. It was supposed to be in person in Amsterdam. Instead, it's virtual. Mm. And I agreed to do my full day workshop that I normally do with them on the SharePoint framework, but I failed to confirm the timing of it prior to committing to it. And when it happened and they started marketing it and people started registering for it, and then I found out about logistics that I was going to have to start teaching at 4 a.m. my time, I was like, hold on now. I committed to this, but I got to work with you guys a little bit because I've got kids that do have school, and if I start teaching, I'm going to wake them up. So can we push this around? And of course, they said yes, and I got to move it around a little bit, but I then completely screwed up my time zone modifications.
Conversions?
Yeah, conversions.
Yeah.
So I thought I was going to start at 6:30 in the morning, but instead I started at 5:30. So, man, that was rough. But it was interesting. There was that, and then it was just been a crazy week, man.
Pretty nutty.
Has been. How about you?
Oh, yeah. No, it's actually been a fairly quiet week for me, actually. I've been writing a little bit of code, which has been exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a few couple of work-related things and a couple of non-work-related things, mm-hmm. which has been kind of fun, learning a bit of new tech and playing around with some data and using some new services in Azure and things to do it. So that was that's kind of on the personal side. And on the work side, I've been getting in and writing a bit of code for Hyperfish and making some bug fixes. You know, have you ever had those moments where you go back and you look at code and you're like, well, I mean, every developer's had the moment where they've like, I don't understand why this bug is happening. It's definitely not in this code, right? That's the first stage. And then the second code is, oh, I see where it's happening. And then the third stage is, I'm not sure how this ever worked, right?
there's a t-shirt about that, right? There's like a t-shirt that is so perfect. You look at it and you read through it, you're like, yeah, I've been there. I have no idea how this ever worked.
Yeah. So I had a few of those moments. And it turns out it's code I wrote. So I'm like, who was the noob who wrote this? Oh, actually, looking at the commit history, that was me.
So I'll do you one better with that. I had a similar one just recently where I had a bunch of custom JavaScript that I wrote for my company site. When I relaunched the site and then I did all the scripts, quote, the right way, where they all have like automated testing. They're all done in TypeScript instead of JavaScript. And instead of them all just dumped in the global scope, I've got like, you know, module loaders and all that kind of stuff. So I did it the right way. And one of the things that I did, I had written tests for about a year or two ago. And when I went back to go write the code and I kind of migrated over to my new setup, it wasn't working. And I couldn't figure out why it wasn't working. And I went back and looked and I can't figure out how the old tests even pass. I mean, it passes and it runs, but I have under no circumstance should it ever have passed. And I was like, how is it? Is it like a race condition? Is it async and the test is passing before it really finishes to really evaluate if it's going to be false? And I could never figure it out. And I finally threw that test out and rewrote it. Like, all right, this is when it should absolutely work. And it's the good thing is it's one of those scenarios where there's only one time when it can work, but there's a lot of times it shouldn't work. And so writing a test for it to work was very easy. And then writing a handful of other tests that here's all these random scenarios where it should not work. I finally got that working and then deployed it. Now I have more visibility and man, it just, yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we all have. Anybody who's written code feels, I'm sure, in the heart of hearts, had one of those moments.
Yeah, yeah.
But hey, now, you've been pretty busy this week as well. You've launched a new bunch of blogs or something, right? Articles?
Yeah, I mentioned it a little bit last week, but I wanted to call it out again this week. I'm glad you brought it up because I actually want to call it out too. Starting last week, or I guess by the time this episode comes out, it was starting on October the 6th or 7th, I think. And then all the way through to today, October the 15th, I've got a 5-part series that I've published that is answering the what, why, when, where, who, and how questions about the SharePoint framework. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but there are questions that I always get asked or at least the answers are that I haven't, what I've written in these posts is very frequently the answer or the explanation I give to many different questions. And it's just nice to be able to point to something and just say, when someone asks a question going, go read the how, that explains what's going on. Like, no, I just need the footnotes. I'm like, no, I've done that for 3 years. Go read this. So
right.
I've been really happy to see how people have reacted to this. And yeah, so if you're new to the SharePoint framework, this would help. But then there's also the how question. The one that's the how and the why are the two that I really wanted to write. But the other two, all the other ones I had to write at the same time. The how is something that I think even people who've been doing SPFX dev for a little while may get a lot out of. And because it really explains like the nuts and bolts of what's going on and why things aren't loading from my machine. Instead, they're loading from the app catalog when I've, you know, changed versions and stuff like that. And like, go read this. So, but I'll tell you, one of the things I did with this is one of the things I wanted to mention. And I held off on this for a while to share this. I mean, it's no secret that I've got a pretty poor track record, or I have a track record of jumping between different like task management apps or note-taking apps or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I was
one. I think you've changed 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
But here's the difference, though, between you and I. You make lists of tasks and things. I'm not good at any of that.
Well, it is.
So although I've stuck with, well, basically two. I used to use Wunderlist and now I'm using To-Do, but I've barely used them, right? So
this isn't a task management thing that I want to call out. This one, I still use the same stuff that I've been using. I use To-Do to kind of share stuff with family, like our grocery list is in their hardware store, stuff like that. But there's not a lot of stuff in it. I use something called Teamwork Project for most of that. But what I wanted to call out was that the thing about like note-taking, I have like a love-hate relationship with OneNote. And about a month ago, it became a much more hate relationship when it totally crapped out, lost the sync between a couple of my notebooks. And I had to go all the way down to manually removing them from my iPad, deleting the OneNote app, and then reinstalling the OneNote app after I knew that it, like all the cache data was gone. And then one by one, opening them up. And between the different, because of Teams, now everything's got its own notebook and I have like 6-7 notebooks and trying to get them all to like pull in and sync, and then the sync would crap out again. And I just got so in a rage. I was like, you know what? I'm going to try something different for a bit. Something I played with about 2 months ago. And then I was like, I don't really have time to migrate everything. I decided to just say, you know what? This is going to be like a strangulation pattern. I'm going to try this thing out. And if I like it, I'll just start moving pieces of stuff from OneNote over to this. It's an app called Notion. It is very much like a cross between a OneNote / Evernote / Wiki / personal database and authoring app. And I'm loving it for writing blog posts. It's been absolutely fantastic for planning out this course that I'm a new course that I'm working on. I'll talk about in a future show. I'm absolutely loving it. The sync is just seamless. The only thing it doesn't do that I wish it did was support handwriting for
on an iPad or something.
Yeah, on an iPad and with like a pencil. It's the only thing it doesn't support. That's the only downside to it. I like to use that to kind of sketch out stuff, not to write. I don't like to handwrite notes, but to sketch out like an architecture or a flow or something. And for the meantime, I'm just using the Apple Notes app and then sketch stuff out, screenshot it, resize it, save it, and then add it as an image to the note in Notion. So
gotcha.
It's cool. So I'm playing around with it, and it's I've been using it now for a few weeks, and I'm liking it more and more every day.
I've heard of it before, but I've not used it. Like somebody else mentioned it to me a while back. It looks pretty interesting.
It's got a lot of great integrations. It's got stuff like
things like this. That the one thing that freaks me out about it, and I guess I haven't used it, so I don't really know if this is valid or not, is like getting your data out.
So
if you ever want to move, or if you, you know what I mean? Like that feeling of like all your stuff's in it, but can I get it out? Like OneNote, I feel sort of it's more like documents than it is an app, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but if you've ever worked with OneNote,
not really, but
if you ever work with a OneNote API, the data you get back is really hard to work with.
Yeah, but like there's OneNote files. Like I've got a file with all my stuff in it.
Yeah.
I know this is like, I sound like an old granddad when I'm talking about this, right? But
no, I get it.
I know it's not valid, but it's like, this feels like more like an app that I couldn't, like for whatever reason, the app stopped working. It doesn't feel quite the same for some reason to me.
So think about it like this. It is much more like Evernote than it is like OneNote. And that Evernote is a bunch of records. That's really what this is. It's a bunch of records, but it's like a record with records inside of it. So each like paragraph and a note is a separate, what they call block, but you can have a list block. You can have a calendar block and it's really slick. But the thing that the one thing I haven't done with this is I haven't like done like a OneNote to Notion migration because it doesn't exist. Mm. So there are people who have been begging for it. It looks like they do. They go from OneNote to Evernote, and then there's a native Evernote to Notion migration. But Notion has an API that's coming out in the next like month or two, or early in the Q1 of 2021. So when that happens, they expect a lot of people to start doing more stuff with it. But I'm finding like a lot of different like extensions to it, and there's integration all over the place. I know Microsoft is doing like the Uber Note thing, but I really don't want Microsoft's approach to it, like with all their other stuff, is that it's not going to be a very open system. It's going to be everything Office 365. But if you want to use it outside of 365, it's going to be a pain. And I didn't want that. So
makes sense.
Yeah, it's cool. I have to show it to you sometime. I'm loving it. I showed it to two or three other people who are like Mike Fitzmaurice. Just he ditched Evernote and he switched over to Notion now.
All right.
Yeah, I know a bunch of people that are doing it, but it's cool.
I'd like to look at it.
It's cool. It's cool.
Yeah, it's free for personal use.
Yeah, I haven't paid anything for it. I haven't paid a dime.
Hey, should we jump into some news?
Sounds good to me.
This episode is sponsored by Raygun. Have you ever wondered if you could be offering a faster, less buggy application experience for your customers? With Raygun Application Performance Monitoring, you have all the information you need at your fingertips to find and fix errors and performance problems across your tech stack down to the line of code. With Raygun, monitor the impact of your performance improvements, quickly identify and resolve issues, and see how your code performs in the hands of your customers, saving you time, money, and sanity. I've personally used Raygun and Hyperfish for the last 4 years to help me sleep better at night, knowing the customers we've worked so hard to get are having a great experience. We use Raygun to alert engineers proactively so that we can be the ones to tell customers when we've fixed the problem instead of them calling us to say something's wrong. Raygun.com is my secret weapon in shipping high-quality code. Check it out at Raygun.com and get up and running in minutes. This podcast is brought to you by Nintex. If you could score an extra hour or two back in your day, would you take it? Because our friends over at Nintex want to give you a gift, the gift of time. Seriously, if you haven't checked out what Nintex has to offer lately, you definitely should. The platform built on Azure has evolved a lot. In just the past few months, the Nintex team has added new process mapping capabilities, and most recently, a new eSign capability called Nintex Sign, powered by Adobe Sign. Nintex also continues to revolutionize products you know and trust, including Nintex Workflow and Forms. With the power of Nintex, it is faster and easier for you to configure, not code, giving you valuable time back every day to sprint it however you want. Test drive the Nintex Process Cloud at nintex.com. And we're back. All right, AC, we've got a few things this week. We've got a bit of Zoom news, we've got a bit of Microsoft news, we've got some hardware stuff and some 365 bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about kicking us off with something from Zoom?
Yeah, I'll do that. So Zoom is having their big, I think it's called Zoomtopia, is a big conference that they have for all their users. Mm. They've had a bunch of announcements that have come out from it. I think the three biggest ones that I've seen, one was around true end-to-end encryption for your meetings. It's rolling out in four phases. Interesting. It's definitely interesting. Another thing that they've added, which I've tried to use this, I can't figure out how to get this to work, but you can have Zaps, which are Zoom apps. Unfortunate name because the Zap is also something at Zapier, but you can have Zoom apps in your meeting. Like, for example, if I wanted to, there's actually a Notion app to where we could have notes going on for when we were doing our podcast.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is Zoom. In Zoom, yeah, right inside the app. So that's interesting.
It's like Teams have added the ability to extend, you know, put apps inside meetings now as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's it. And the other one, the one that I'm going to put in the show notes, it's called OnZoom. And it's supposed to be an event, like kind of catering to the virtual conference space. And it's in beta, but they have it looks like they're putting together the ability to do using Zoom to host events, both having like paid events, selling tickets to the events and all that stuff. So it's still, there's like a whole like host experience. There's a whole attendee experience. It's hard to kind of really dive in to see much about it because it has to be added to your account because it's still like in preview. And I'm curious to see where they go with this because this is a pretty hot space. And you and I were in Facebook thread with some people yesterday about this whole thing that came up about, you know, using Microsoft Teams for virtual conferences. I know some people have done some really great things with it. I've yet to really be in one of these virtual conferences that use Teams where I felt like it was a good experience for both the presenter and the attendants or the attendees. And it's nothing against Teams. It's just, that's not what Teams today is not well suited for an event like that, in my humble opinion.
No, I agree. It's interesting to see them do this. I guess they've been hustled along by COVID and adding more of these sort of capabilities to Zoom. Zoom's always been very true to its mission, right? Just very focused about the meeting experience. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see them branch out a little bit into some other bits and pieces, but don't lose sight of the fact that, you know, you should just do crisp audio and clear video and meetings that work every time. It should be the focus for sure.
Yeah. From what I've read about it, on a couple of the tech articles, it looked really good, but the experiences that they're, or like the first preview when you go to the landing page, everything's kind of like, wait a minute, are you sure that that's what this is intended for? Because I see things about learning how to work out my legs and my glutes and then yoga and handcrafted cocktails. I'm like, I thought that this was for events. Like, I'm a little confused.
Yeah.
So
maybe they're starting a different type of event. I don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah.
What do you got for
us? All right. So from Microsoft, there was an article this week that came out based on a memo that internally went out to a bunch of Microsoft staff saying, Microsoft is reportedly to allowing its 150,000 employees to work from home permanently.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the details of this are kind of, you know, I guess this is, you know, not new to a lot of companies. A lot of companies have gone more remote friendly or virtual friendly, right? But this is a pretty big deal for Microsoft, especially the main Redmond area, right, where I'm based, has been very heavily, not dependent, but, you know, the campus is a big part of Microsoft, right? And I think it will continue, but the point here is like they're getting more flexible over it. And it'll be interesting to see how companies like of this scale handle changes like this. They're obviously doing okay because they've not been at work for probably 6 months now, I suppose, maybe more. And they seem to be doing all right. But so this is kind of more looking forward. They're talking about January, about going back to work. This has come out now saying, you know, after that time, it'll be at your discretion and at your manager's discretion about whether you go into the office or not, mm-hmm. or need to work from the office. But at least initially they're saying sort of 50-50 split between home and office, mm-hmm. or virtual and office. And then it's more than that if, but again, it's completely up to your manager and your discretion about working it out. So it'll be interesting to see what other companies do in this regard. Microsoft's just yet another one that's making the move towards more virtual friendly. They've obviously proven out that they can do it. And so, you know, why not?
Mm-hmm.
But so the interesting part about this is right now, a huge portion of the Microsoft campus is a building site,
mm-hmm.
where they're building a massive new development. They tore down a lot of the older buildings on the original part of campus. So some of the X-shaped buildings that you will have been in,
mm-hmm.
those, not all of them have gone, but a lot of them have gone. And some of the older buildings, huge, like where all the fields were at Microsoft, all the baseball fields and all of that's been completely ripped out, and they're building a whole new part of campus in there. There's new overpasses over the freeway. There's like all sorts of stuff going on at the moment. And it makes you think, like, man, they started that about a year too early, didn't they?
When I saw this, I thought the same thing. I was like, man, I remember there was a lot of construction going on out there. But when you have these big companies with these huge campuses, like, what is that going to affect? How is that going to affect this work from home going, you know, beyond the pandemic? Like, how is it going to affect them? Are you going to see buildings shutting down? Are you going to see buildings kind of being outsourced? Are they going to let our ISVs going to buy some of these buildings to try and be work closer to Microsoft?
Microsoft was having space problems in the Puget Sound region anyway. Like, they were renting buildings in Bellevue off people. They're renting buildings in Seattle off people and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, they had big space problems to begin with. And so, you know, we might see them retreat more to campus to use up this new space when it becomes available. But yeah, it's certainly going to shake things up. That's for sure.
That's interesting. It'd be interesting to see how this all shakes out.
Yeah.
So I have an article that came across. I saw it on Hacker News, and it's not so much I'm trying to call out a bug or something, but it was more that it raised a question that I asked a couple of people, and I think you had the same reaction to it, which the title of this is from a VPN provider, and the article is Linux under the Windows subsystem for Linux 2 can be leaking. And it just talks about, like, explains kind of what they think may be going on. But what this really uncovered was when you're on WSL, your internet traffic, your network traffic is not going through Windows Defender. It's not going through the firewall. It's not going through the stuff that, you know, that Windows, the host OS, is all the security features of Windows. It doesn't appear that that traffic from WSL is actually going through all those things, which was surprising to me. I asked a few people about this, and somebody in the security space and at Microsoft about it. And they're like, yeah, it doesn't go through it because it's running essentially like its own little VM. Like, yeah, but I thought that the benefit of being on Windows, I still thought it would still be going through it. So it was very surprising to me when I saw this. Maybe our listeners are like, duh, but
I read that and I was like, yeah, that's how I would expect it to work.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it was supposed to go through or should have gone through all that stuff. Anyway, yeah, kind of curious. Like, I didn't really see what the big deal was.
That's what should happen.
Yeah, maybe I'm just clueless in this regard. Uh-huh. Okay, so Microsoft has been on another buying spree. Well, maybe not a spree. They've bought the game publisher Bethesda Softworks for $7.5 billion.
Mm.
The creator of Elder Scrolls, Fallout, Doom, and other key franchises. So apparently they bought this game publisher with the view to sort of bolster Xbox and the, you know, sort of the Game Pass bundle subscription piece.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that's only part of it, right? But they're going to put it in Game Pass so you get all those games as part of your subscription as well, which obviously makes a lot of sense there. Now, what was interesting about this Mary Jo Foley article that we'll link to that sort of made my eyes pop was that Microsoft, with this acquisition, will have grown its number of game studios from 15 to 23. It's like, what? I thought that was...
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Maybe she meant game franchises.
I would think so.
Because with one acquisition, how do you go from 15 to 23?
I mean...
maybe it's multiple studios.
It's got to be.
Yeah. Yes. So, anyway. So, yes, Doom and The Elder Scrolls and Fallout and so forth will follow to Microsoft.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I have a bit of old news, but meaning to mention, it's worth actually mentioning though. Microsoft, the Azure Active Directory group, Microsoft Identity, they announced a new feature that's now in GA. It's called the Azure AD My Sign-Ins. So what this is for is like enterprise users can review their sign-in history to check and see if there's been any unusual activity for their sign-in. So using that, they can take a look and see, you know, if somebody is potentially trying to guess their password or if an attacker successfully signed into their account from a location that they know they weren't there, or they can see what apps what apps they actually accessed. Hmm. The part that's new here to this feature or to this capability, other than it just being announced to GA, one of the things they added was a capability for you to flag a certain request to "this wasn't me" or "this was me" kind of thing. If these activities are flagged as unusual activities. And so you'll be able to use this to let Microsoft know that, hey, you know, that this wasn't me. I need you to delete the sign on or invalidate the key or something like that. But it also is providing feedback back to Microsoft to help them improve the accuracy of risk detection systems, which I mean, they're always modifying. They're always updating and refining to make better.
Makes sense. They've had this in Microsoft account for, you know, MSA for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. You can go in and see your history and all that sort of stuff and flag things as "this wasn't me," which, you know, if you ever hit that button, good luck, because in MSA, that means basically access to everything gets revoked and you reset your password.
Yeah.
So it causes all sorts of chaos and mayhem.
Yeah.
I don't know what happens if you hit the "this wasn't me" button in Azure AD. Like, what happens? Do you get kicked out immediately? I don't know.
Yeah, and never get back in?
Yep. Oh, no, here it says, yes, if you click "this wasn't me," they would see the following dialogue. "It looks like someone else may have gained access to your account. You need to change your password and review your security info." Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So they're going to kick you through the same sort of flow, I imagine. And it'll, revoke. I imagine it will revoke consent to apps that you've given consent to and all that sort of stuff as well. Probably. Mm-hmm. Possibly. I guess we will see. Hey, on a little bit of Windows 10 and Surface type stuff, you know how Microsoft's making ARM devices now? For mm-hmm. Surface, like there's an ARM-based option for Windows. Apparently, the cool part about that is they've worked on it so that you can run Win32 apps, like, you know, desktop apps that have been compiled for x86, and you can run them on these devices using some emulation. Now they're also doing that for 64-bit apps as well, so that the health department in Britain can track COVID cases effectively with 64-bit version of Excel. That part I'm joking about.
It's a hat tip to our last episode.
Yes. So they've got more than, what is it, 15,000 columns or whatever in Excel. So yes, 64-bit versions of apps will be able to run on Windows for ARM now, which is pretty interesting because, you know, it means that traditional laptop makers could make ARM laptops and run the same stuff as they would have on a Intel, you know, AMD-based x86 processor, but do it on ARM, which is, I don't know, the techie in me thinks that's pretty cool.
Mm. Yeah, that's neat.
How usable? I don't know.
I've got a little bit of news from the Microsoft Graph team. The Microsoft Graph team has announced a general availability of the Microsoft Graph Teams membership API. So prior to this API coming out, you had to use the groups, the Office 365 groups API to add and remove people from having access to a team. A lot of times when you did this, when you made that change, the action was taken immediately. However, there were plenty of times, like for example, adding or removing a user would take up to 48 hours for it to take effect, which is kind of a pain. So now what's interesting about this, the new APIs are, they're allowing you to, you know, add to list all your members, add and remove members, change member roles, like taking somebody from an owner to a non-owner or vice versa. They allow you to do all of that stuff with the Microsoft Graph API for Teams membership. One of the things it mentions though in the post, and I'm really curious to be like, to see like what kind of an improvement it is, because you see that 48 hours is like, that's way too long. They say they were designed with latency and reliability in mind. Like, so does that mean they're immediate? Or does that mean that they're like an hour, 5 minutes? I don't know. I mean, I would think that if you design with latency, my assumption is we're going from 42 down to it's immediate. But they're not clear about that. The fact that they're not clear about that kind of scares me.
Surely all APIs should be designed with latency and reliability in mind.
Well, and so that's like the low-hanging fruit. Like, so do you say you fixed it? It's no longer 48?
That comment, I just read that in this post, really doesn't mean anything, does it?
The fact that you they're expect, actually, it gives me a little bit of concern.
Yeah, like you expect API calls to the graph to not take 30 seconds to complete.
Yeah.
Right? And that's not even latency. Latency is like, you know, the time between you and the graph, right? And the things like that. So maybe they're using the wrong word for that. But in reliability, you expect APIs to work every time. Those aren't features.
That's the minimum
bar. Those are just table stakes, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe they were coming from such a low bar with the group APIs that they really were focused just on latency and reliability.
Yeah.
But I doubt it.
It's kind of like, you know, you're calling out that this car has four wheels and they all roll. It's like, well, so is that, are you proud of that? Because that's what the rest of us kind of expect.
Yeah. I'm curious, huh?
I'm not trying to poke fun at him or anything. I just found that the inclusion of that statement was just, it kind of raised an eyebrow like, huh?
All right. So very, very quickly before we move on to picks, apparently there's a new version of the Exchange Server coming out. And now onto the picks. Yeah. I don't really know what more to say about that. Let's move on.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework. Back to the show.
Okay, AC. Picks, what do you got for us this week?
Hey, you like Kubernetes, right?
I love Kubernetes.
Microsoft just bought Bethesda Software, so they have Doom now, right?
Oh, yes, true.
Do you ever have to kill your Kubernetes pods for Hyperfish?
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes, well, yeah.
If you want to have some fun, somebody has now set up to where you can now use Doom to kill your Kubernetes pods. They're walking around a little field and you walk around and you have the gun and it's like the old school Doom.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
This is fantastic. So I can walk around shooting pods and getting rid of them out of our cluster.
Mm-hmm. And the easiest thing about it is that you just need to spin up a Kubernetes, what's it called? Kube Dom. It's in a container. So you just have to spin the container up in your Kubernetes cluster and attach a VNC client to a specific port, 5901, and ta-da, you're playing Zoom, or you're playing Doom, and there go your pods.
Wow. Maybe we should have a Zoom meeting where we can play Doom, killing pods in Kubernetes. Then it'd be a Zoom Doom pod killing meeting.
Would this not be like the ultimate chaos monkey? Because then you could have like red team and green team and you literally are having like a battle and it's like playing video games, but you're trying to see how resilient.
You just put your kids into the game.
Well, yeah. I mean,
let them run around killing stuff.
Let's make it really resilient. So we have to defend a bunch of teenagers playing Doom because we're not going to be able to stand up to these guys. They're so much better at first.
But it is Doom. Shooters. They won't know what to do.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, they've probably never played Doom.
Two pixels.
That's cool, man. I like that one.
How about you? What you got for us?
I have a new series that I learned about from Buzz Aldrin on Facebook, which is called The Right Stuff.
Mm.
If you're familiar with the old movie, The Right Stuff, or the book, The Right Stuff, this is a new Disney Plus edition, I suppose. So it's by National Geographic, and it's drawn inspiration from the book and the movie, and it premieres on October the 9th, so it's already out, which is pretty cool. I have not watched it yet, but I just thought I'd throw it out there as this looks pretty cool, and I quite liked the movie, and I'm going to go watch it and see what it's all about.
That's a cool pick. I saw somebody mention this, and I didn't realize that it was new. I thought it was existing stuff that had been ported over, so that's cool that it's new content. I think I'm starting to feel like I'm the last person on the planet that has not signed up for Disney Plus yet, and I'm really enjoying this because when there is some massive, like you have to stay home and you just have to binge TV or some other reason to do it. I don't know, like if there's a pandemic, I've got a great reason now to sign up for Disney Plus because I'm going to have the first two seasons of Mandalorian that I have yet to watch yet. And I'm going to have The Right Stuff from National Geographic to be able to watch on Disney Plus as well. So I'm going to just go get a bunch of soda, a bunch of popcorn, stop shaving for about 2 weeks and enjoy my Disney Plus.
Just binge. Good call. Good call. No, this looks pretty nice. I'm looking forward to watching it. I will give you a review once I have.
Oh, please do. Please do.
All right, AC. Another good week. And we'll be back at it next week with more exciting news and info.
Absolutely. Take care, CJ.
You too.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in your favorite podcast app. It helps people find out about our show and grow our audience, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a wave or MP3 and provide us a link so we can play it on the show. You can also subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, the Google Play Store, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. And finally, sign up for our mailing list by heading over to microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll get notices of each episode, as well as the show notes sent to you directly each week. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Thanks for listening.